We have a bigger spread between skill level than we've had in the other exercises. So to prevent us from wasting too much time, I'm going to continue moving just like before. I don't want people to be idle when we have more content to cover. So if you're not finished yet, you're not behind or anything. You just haven't done it before. There's a lot of things if you're typing instead of tab completing, it takes you longer. If you're reading, it's going to take you a little longer. But I wanted to draw your attention to a couple of things that are differences. Again, like finer gotchas. In Meterpreter, for example, you have a shell command that gives you an interactive channel. But since this is asynchronous, Empire is, if you run the shell command on your agent, it's a single-shot PowerShell command. So I'm sending it the PS version table command, which is going to instantiate that object and show me the output, but it's a hash table, and Empire is going to be confused. This isn't a PowerShell exe, it's Empire, so it's going to say, I don't know what to do with that. So I'm forcing it to go to the outstring command, which forces it to be interpreted as strings. You don't always have to do that in PowerShell exe, but because it's a single shot PowerShell command, I'm doing that to see the output here. Also wanted to show you, while some of you are still working, that's perfectly okay. I'm going to do that use module. And if I'm inside an agent, it already knows it's PowerShell and not Python. If I'm outside, I might have to say PowerShell first. But this is a PowerShell agent, so I don't have to say that. I can say use module. Let's do the... Well, first I'll do the script import. You can do the one that I have here exactly as is in the book, but I wanted to show you the canonical way for one reason, and I'll explain when I get there. So use module, management, and invoke script. If I do this way instead of just a script import and script command aliases that are in the Empire agent, if I go info here, you can see I can apply this to more than one agent. I can set an agent there. So first, let's do the set script path to opt ps invoke mkw. Same exactly as in the book, but not the script import command, but invoke script module. And set script command to invoke mkw. And notice under agent, I can tab. And what do I have for agent options? The agent I renamed to agent Z, all and auto run. What do you think all does? All the agents that are currently connected, I'll go grab their passwords. Auto run, what do you think auto run does? On first initial connection is when it runs. Yeah, pretty close. The important differentiation here is auto run will run on new agents. So if I do auto run, any of the existing agents won't run it. It's only new agents. When they first connect, they will auto run that. So I could do that. And every time a new agent comes, I can have it automatically try to steal passwords from memory. I don't have to interactively do it. So I'm going to just do it to the agent I have, though. Since I only have one, it doesn't really matter. And while it's doing that, I guess, we got to wait. I mean, you can sit there and look at it for a while. I mean, I can see the cool ASCII art logo that comes across and just wait for it. And there, I actually get it. I did have TeamViewer running on my victim, and it stole these credentials, which it uses with the TeamViewer website. This is TeamViewer 11. It's a little older. 14 is out now. 14 actually changes the password to have more than just digits. So you actually have to update my script to detect the 14 version, but this is the live version. Got those credentials from TeamViewer's website, and I was able to steal it. You'll get the browser credentials as well. I made my victim also connect to a gateway and get internet access. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to see this. I also like to, while I'm at it, before we move on, an attack isn't complete without using our troll exploit. And let's do It's not a proper attack without a rickroll. This might slow it down quite a bit. We'll see. And the internet access was so slow. Of course, I'm an impatient attacker, so I'm going to troll him harder and do use module troll exploit. Well, I'm outside, so this time I do have to do PowerShell troll exploit. Thunderstruck. That's video URL. It doesn't have to be a video URL. It's going to auto open it. That's how you make it go anywhere. So if somebody has like saved remember me with a cookie checkbox on a website, you send the browser to that website, you might be able to steal the cookie from the website using Invoke MimiKittens if you add a regular expression to Invoke MimiKittens that looks for that particular cookie. Everybody follow that idea? These are not saved credentials. Like remember it, it's in memory. So even if I don't remember those usernames and passwords and cookies, as long as it's still in the browser, I can steal it. Here I'm starting a browser, trying to send it to a URL in hopes that there's something that does remember that I can steal it. Yeah? But, of course, we can just set agent to all and run. And maybe that'll eventually work. I don't know. Is it muted? Let's see, do I have... At least my computer should work. Oh, I forgot to answer the dialogue there. Back to agents. Interact with agent Z. It says it completed it, but for whatever reason, it's not showing up. There's the volume. So the second troll is started. If I look at it and you really want to see it work, we can go task manager and we can pull up Internet Explorer. It's actually going to be the largest of the Internet Explorers running is the one that has it. We can look at the go to details. We can look at the command line by adding the column here. Nope, not that. Select columns. Come on. There it is. Command line. Anyway, you could see everything about it if you really wanted to. But the internet connection is so slow, this thing's really struggling on downloading it. So there's nothing fun to hear. Anyway, something to experiment with on your own in the future. Now I'm going to remember to mute this. So that doesn't scare me as we're presenting. All right. So as I said before, I don't expect everybody had finished that yet, but enough people are done. We're going to move forward. The next stuff we can do with Empire would also follow on with this, what we have so far. Okay. I also like to highlight this persistence that we have here. It's a real favorite of mine. I'm using two in the classroom because we don't have patience for 3 minutes. But 3 minutes is a little more believable that, okay, it's idle. Someone didn't just, blink and the screensaver started ticking on the timer kind of a thing. 3 minutes is a little safer and we can still do that. Any new agent is going to start a new agent when it's idle at that point. So that's a fun one to do. You can go through and use the stage of the macro on your own. Again, we can leverage the access we already have, starting it inside of the Word doc. The VBA macros are great because they do get API access to Windows APIs, so we can do some other fun stuff. I also take advantage of the HTTP in the file open coming up here to deliver it. And so you can do this on your own. If you haven't had a chance to do it yet, I will say on this 164, if you type this in and you type the address wrong or the listener's no longer listening, you will get weird error messages when it can't actually download the file because the macro import dialog doesn't know that you're trying to load from a URL. So it's going to say something weird like permission denied, but it means that your listener isn't there. It's not that you don't have permission. It's just literally cannot read the file. It assumes it's a permission problem. So don't be too surprised if you see that, but you can walk through those instructions again. You should be seeing this when you get to the Mimikatz portion. If you don't, it's probably because you closed the Internet Explorer, the setup script started, so there was something to steal. And I will also point out that, yes, you don't actually log in to the Mimikittens Wars website. Kitten Wars website. There we go. You don't actually log in. This is just a string in the get URL that's proof of concept. It still is the same if it's post. It just has to be in memory. If you let that browser idle long enough, the heap memory manager is going to move around this memory, and you'll see different copies of this password multiple times. It might even be somewhat damaged, where a few bytes have been reallocated. But expect that you'll see at least something valid when you do run that. As long as the browser is still running, you should see it. All right? As I was saying, though, we're not going to wait for everybody. Please feel free to continue on your own. We're going to cover some general things before we still talk about the last module, which is modern bypasses like AMSI bypasses, which we just added for this version. Okay? So first, let's talk about some general escape and escalation isms. Take a step back from what we looked at with things that were Windows-centric with remote desktops. We have some things that we can take advantage of on Linux, OpenBSD, for example. There's a lot of already restrictions in place in these, but we can choose to further harden it. We can use SE Linux. We can use AppArmor to protect applications. They do it a little differently, so circumventing those hinges on how it's implemented. How well is it configured? Does the, for example, application, if it has SE Linux, we have to start doing inode shenanigans, like messing with hard links and file system tricks, like really hardcore things to get around SE Linux. That's one of those things people usually install. They say, oh, SE Linux sounds like a great idea, and they check the box to add that, and then they remove it immediately because they can't use their machine. It's pretty secure, almost to a fault, where it's unusable. If you don't take the time to configure it to do the things you should allow it to do. AppArmor tends to be a little more forgiving because it does it by file path. It's a little less aggressive. To circumvent AppArmor protections, we might be able to manipulate some things on the file system by file name tricks, like mounting a file system on top of another file system, on top of itself. We might be able to trick some file path issues. But either way, if it's an application that's allowed to do something, I can still use that application to do that thing. Like if it's an Oracle database server or MySQL database server, doesn't matter. That program is still going to be able to talk to the data, right? If it's a web server that's allowed to interact with a database server, I'm going to be able to run something as a user of that web server that can interact with that database. I'm abusing something that application is allowed. So for attacking, I just abuse what is allowed. That's the overall idea. So generally speaking, treat it like a video game. You want to uncover possible things, walk around, look at everything, and then don't forget that things might change. Things you might have missed might be there. So you want to revisit those ideas. Maybe it, when you weren't looking, the situation changed a little bit. Don't be afraid to revisit. It's that fog of war that happens. You know, there might be other things happening when you're not looking. Come back and revisit it. Look for obscure inputs. What kinds of creative ways can we manipulate these things? And of course, overall, keep in mind, if we can escalate, it's a lot easier to escape when you can change the rules of the game, right? If you can escalate to root or administrator, it's a lot easier to change those rules. Services are a great source of escalation opportunities. So whether it's Windows or Linux, try to look for services you can control. Maybe you can't directly say, start this service, but if you can, force the machine to reboot because you social engineer a call to the help desk saying the server's not responding or whatever, or denial of service, it somebody gives up and just reboots it. Those are still control methods. They're just not, you know, exclusive technically to your skill set and permissions. I have been doing that on occasion, even though it's Maybe we're on assessment that's not designed to be social engineering. I'll still do it. Why? Because my argument is, if I can make a phone call and do something like, hey, you know that web server that you said was mission critical? I think I broke it. Can you go reboot it? They reboot it. Everything's fine. Oh, maybe that's not it. Maybe it was this other server, and eventually get them to the one I want them to reboot so it starts my evil service that I've Trojaned, which we skipped over how, but let's say I did that. I'm not making a lot of friends, but I was able to force something to happen within the window that I was testing it. I'm not testing their security awareness, social engineering. I'm just making sure their technical stuff happened when I was testing. So I don't call it social engineering, although other people have. Not fair. Oh, out of scope. I'm like, but not out of scope. I just made sure you did it. Maybe I tricked you, sure, but I made sure you did it while I was testing it. This is the technical issue, not a social engineering issue. But you can call it social engineering, I guess, if that helps. I'm just saying that there might be multiple ways I can manipulate a service. Now, what could I manipulate besides the start and stop? Maybe I can change the environment variables, which are still treated as inputs. I see a lot of times, especially on like Oracle, we're going to Oracle a lot right now, but Oracle database servers, especially if they have multiple versions of the Oracle database for different applications, there's different environments for each one. Different users, different stuff set up in the Bash RC so that stuff's just right when they start that particular database. I look for those kinds of things. I look for maybe special libraries that are in /lib or userlib or et cetera or any other kinds of related files. Don't forget you still have a lot of things in Meterpreter. We have some post-exploitation stuff. We have some local here, and it's not just Windows. Under OS here, you may find stuff like multi for stuff like escaping out of a Java virtual machine. So look for that. That might come in handy. But you need to look around a little bit. On Windows, you can do WMI queries or other things. Right-click on my computer and see what version of Windows is it. Do some looking around and see if there's any known flaws. Here on this Linux example or embedded whatever appliance, we can do uname-a. It's going to show us a lot of kernel version stuff that we can Google, cross-reference. Look at et cetera issue, issue.net. Those files will give you more distribution. Like, is it Debian Potato or like what you'll use day four, the Kubuntu Precise Pangolin or whatever. You might see that in et cetera issue, whereas the kernel version, the compiled timestamp and everything will show up as uname minus A. I can also look at OS release and maybe I'll see something. Look at the apt configurations under var apt. I might see something. Also, I can look for those custom applications that are good candidates for exploitation. Here, this find command, I'm just going to highlight something real quickly because I find people do this wrong. They remember something like this, but they remember it wrong. What is the find command doing here? Starting at the root, look for either the set group ID or the set user ID. But the minus O is an OR. And what's the minus in front of the 2 and the 4? Those of you who are find gurus. What does a minus in front of the 2 mean? Nobody knows? Well, the 2 means the group ID. The 4 means the user ID. But why, those numbers aside, why the minus? Correct. It means treat this as a bit mask. The zeros here mean I don't care about those, not literally look for zeros. That's what the minus means. If I omit the minus on the 2 and the 4, which I see people do all the time incorrectly, you're looking for something literally that is the set group ID or the set user ID bit are set and no other things are set. It's not readable, writable, or executable by anybody. And that, unless you're just trying to prove me wrong, never exists. It doesn't exist in the wild, right? Why would something be set user ID but not executable? It doesn't make sense at all. So you always want to look for the minus 2 or the minus 4. Okay? Sudo minus L, thank you Canonical for your progress in Ubuntu over the past 15 years, pretty much, making a sudo so common where people don't run things as root, but they run things as a user who can just sudo everything as root. It's almost like they're trying to, before Microsoft got involved with Canonical, they tried to be Microsoft, it seems like, in a bad way. But I can sudo minus L to list out what I can do as somebody else. And maybe there's something there. Now, if I did find a custom application that I think is interesting, maybe it opens up a port. I can do a remote exploitation, or I can see it's running as a special user, or it's using a database, or I suspect it is. I can say, is there anything in the user directory with this final find command on the page that is related to this custom application by name? If the name of the application is literally custom underscore app, and I run this find command, I'm going to be seeing readmes, example files, like in the share docs directory, man pages, sample configuration files. Did I say that? Those kinds of things are going to show up. And now I can start playing with the app a little bit. And what I'm looking for is error messages that help me understand, is there anything I might be able to exploit here? I haven't tried to fuzz it yet, but I can get right up to that point here. Tomorrow you'll do fuzzing. I can run this custom application. I can start giving it flags that literally don't exist. Why? I'm just trying to get error messages. Let me know more about the application. What does it expect for this custom application? Error messages can really give you a lot of valuable information. We could go through and actually fuzz it. Here we send it an integer, send it a string, send it a whole bunch of strings. And no matter what error message it is, that might be useful. This is getting right up to where we're going to be in exploitation. When our tools are no longer doing what we need and we need to fix an exploit, we're at this point. Those error messages can give me valuable information, depends on the app, but if I have to understand behavior of the app a little bit better, I can do something like use an ltrace. An ltrace is going to trace the library calls and tell us a little bit more about what's happening. There are other traces that show you more detailed, intimate information. A ktrace will show you kernel level things. There's strace for all system activity. There's dtrace if you've fortunate enough to use something that's ported that from Solaris, or the BSDs were the first to get that. It's also on Linux now. Dtrace for diagnostics, a lot of powerful information. It's like its own little programming language, though. It's very complicated. Here with ltrace, we're just getting a little bit of an idea of what's happening. Through the process of elimination, maybe we did a custom app AA in that example up there, and it says host name not found, or some kind of error message like that. Aha, so let's give it something it can get to. Let's give it an IP address and ltrace it. And what does we see? We see libc calls, and some other stuff happens that snipped out. But a strcat ping and the input we provided, and a system ping in the input we provided, and we see a grep.ttl there too. So let's take a very quick moment and ask ourselves, what kinds of vulnerabilities do we see, those of us who know anything about C or some of those vulnerabilities that are up there? What does that look like? That strcat, how would I exploit that line of code that we see there? A what? A buffer overflow? What makes you believe that that would be a buffer overflow? There's not an N in the str. Anytime you see something with a string and there's not an N, there's no limiting number. The N is in number. So it's not going to stop until it sees a null byte, and it's probably going to put that somewhere where there's not enough space. It's just, if you're not putting in the N, chances are you're not considering the boundaries. So it's probably bad. Yes, it is a buffer overflow. Good answer. What else is vulnerable in that same line of code? Command injection, perfect. I can see that I've given this argument. Now, if I just try to tack on a semicolon at the end of this ltrace user bin custom app 10.10.10.10, and I do a semicolon ID, keep in mind, if you're doing that, I'm actually ending this whole command. I'm not injecting a semicolon into the input. I have to wrap this in double quotes so I don't end, because I'm running this ltrace in a bash prompt. I don't want to end this command, ltrace. I want to end the ping command. So to get something like a semicolon, what other kinds of symbols do we use besides like a semicolon to do a second command? Ampersand is good, yes. Double ampersand works, again, depending upon the shell. Your mileage may vary here. But for Windows, Linux, there's a few of these that work. In Bash especially, though, I love using my backticks. Backticks are great. It'll execute what's inside of that. You also have in Bash the $ parentheses, which will execute what's inside of that. Lots of potential there to get something to run. Now, in this example, though, I also have output filtering. When the system actually executes it, it pipes it to grep.ttl. So I'm not going to see my commands unless they also have the three characters, ttl. It won't pipe through. So how do I bypass the egress filtering, if you will, the output filtering? If I did a command injection, how would I actually see the results of the command? Echo? A pound sign? Yeah, there's a million different things we can do here. I heard a lot of great ones. But there's a couple of classes of things we can do. The easiest one is give it two commands. Inject two commands, and then the grep is going to grep on the second command, which we don't care about. And the first one's not going to get grepped. So we inject two commands. That's usually the easiest. There's a couple other things we could do, but that's the general idea. Maybe two semicolons or ampersands or whatever, and it should echo blah. And we don't care if it doesn't match the TTL because we didn't want that line. So that's our, you know, some things on StirCat there. What else could I do from looking at this last line, the system one? If you can see, it's not exactly good work. It's not an explicit path. So it's using my environment path variable to look for the ping command. I control that as a user. I can set my own path. I can say, first look at my home directory for a ping command, because it didn't say /sbin/ping. And I can give it my ping command. So what would I do? I do a couple of different ways, but for the sake of argument, what if I copied binsh to ping in my home directory, and then I edit my path so that my export path equals blah, 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 but really all I need is my home directory. And then when I run this custom app again, it will ping, but use my ping, which is binsh. So then what happens? If I have binsh minus c1, well, for ping, c1 is a count of one. What is minus c for binsh? It's run this command. Kind of like command cmd.c/c says run this command. Binsh minus c says run the command named one. So then what do? I'm running the command named one. Some Linux distributions will just return true because there is a one command that returns true. It's actually a busy box applet, but it'll usually return true. What do then? I can also Trojan the one command. I just also make copy binsh to one in the same directory, and it's binsh minus c, effectively binsh, and I'm running the shell. Now, if all this is in an SUID executable, I'm not tampering with the actual executable, which would change the permissions. I'm just changing its inputs and the environment it's depending on, right? All right. So you'll spend more time doing stuff later, but I just wanted to kind of get you up to that point. We might have to scratch around and find something in this situation to put our Linux escape and escalate on par with the Windows things we were talking about earlier. I wanted to cover that. All right. Other fun things, I can look and list dynamic dependencies with LDD and look for libraries that might be vulnerable. I can look for also maybe I can replace those libraries with something that directly is exploitable. LD preload is one of those environment variables that should be prevented on SUID executables, but I've seen situations where it still works. It's supposed to not be on modern, but good luck mapping that out. We can look for situations where that's already done by the environment. I've seen it done. I'm picking on Oracle a lot because I see this all the time. And it's set up in the environment so that this box can run a copy of Oracle database 8i for some legacy reason, and there's a 10i version for a different legacy reason or whatever. We can look at that, replace those normal libraries with malicious ones. Well, what kind of a malicious library can we have on Linux? Well, if you've not heard of Metal, Metal is what you want. Metal is a minimal glibc compiled static executable POSIX version of a Linux meterpreter. Really a glibc meterpreter. You can do this. Particular one, we have a shared object, much like a DLL. And, of course, once I have a handler set up ready to go, I can either replace the file in question, the library, or I can add something like this LD preload to the path of my variable and then run any command that honors the LD preload environment, and it's going to load my module also. So here I'm running literally the ls command. It doesn't give me any new privileges because I literally just ran the ls command. It's not suid, is it? But it does run my library. So we can do DLL shenanigans with Linux, is basically what I'm saying. Same exact thing. And of course, Windows will use its path, DLLs, depending upon safe DLL search order settings. By default, it can. We can look for what DLL modules are loaded by what processes this way. We might be able to use process monitor to research and find out a DLL side loading or other hijacking opportunity. I don't like to use the word hijack because it's too close to inject and there's some confusion on what that means. I don't like the word side loading either, to be honest, because it's literally in the path. If I'm using the English language, I don't like it. Side loading, and it's in my path. It's not on the side, it's in front of me. We have some options. Of course, Windows will use the current working directory first and the application directory eventually traversing the path, looking for that. Most of the time, this means there are great UAC bypass opportunities unless somebody's installed applications that add to the path that are user writable. We're not going to see a whole lot of new problems here. Microsoft's done a pretty good job at hardening this by hardening the default environment. The program files directory is pretty relatively secure from standard users. Some other things to keep in mind, maybe I can leverage other tools I have. I love the Magic Unicorn for several reasons. One is it's less typing. I can say Unicorn, and we mentioned it with an HTA earlier today, but I can do the Unicorn in an HTA format, or I can use an SCT, which worked great up until Windows 10 1803, stopped working so well. At that point, maybe it was 1809, but it was definitely in 2018, where the SCT files weren't as useful when we could still execute them. They're just not as useful for, like, UAC bypasses, which you also got that side effect in the past. But whatever we do, we can start that. MSF console will start the receiving part. I also like Trusted Securities, possessive. I guess all sex better be trusted, right? That's, I don't know where I'm going with that. Yikes. their tool, those smart people's tool, Spray W. Mike, Dave Kennedy and his folks on the defensive side, they wrote Spray Device. What this does is it uses a couple of cool components, and it launches a unicorn for every host and target you give it. It is another Python script like the unicorn that wraps other tools. The unicorn wraps MSF Venom, but with Spray WMI, it will launch a unicorn for, you give it the context of a domain or a host name, or a work group here, username and password. You would have had already stole those or guessed them. You could actually use a hash as well if you want to pass the hash. And then you give it an Nmap formatted hostname range. Why? Because it uses Nmap NSE to do a pass the hash psexec style of the unicorn payload, which here is a PowerShell attack command. And you tell it, of course, which unicorn payload to give it, and that's what it does. So this takes, you know, a few seconds to type and run, but I've typed that. It's taken about 20 seconds to actually run after I've typed it and retyped it because I type wrong sometimes. And then I've still had shells come in hours later from this process where it just keeps running. It's pretty magical. All right. But, pretty cool way to apply that thing, on enterprise, because sometimes lateral movement and escalation, are hand in hand. Maybe I'm lucky enough and I stole the credential from something like, Mimikittens that is useful for the web app I stole it from, but it's also a shared credential somewhere else on the network in Windows networking, right? It's all about applying those different things. Some other things to keep in mind, often get asked, what do I know to do with escalation? Well, power up is one I like to use first because it's already available in Empire. It's pretty useful at looking at services as well. But what else do we have? Well, in Windows, we had the classic MBSA. You remember this tool, the Baseline Security Analyzer? It's been phased out and replaced as of Windows 10 and Server 2016. The new way to do it is the Security Compliance Toolkit, SCT. Not to be confused with file names that end in SCT. Those are scriptlets. But the SCT is another three-letter acronym for the Security Compliance Toolkit that Microsoft created. It does look at missing patches, as well as versions of DLLs, configuration of the registry, and, you know, password policy and all those other recommendations it will make. Like, you should really enable SMB signing, disable SMB version 1, those kinds of suggestions. So as an attacker, we can run the compliance toolkit stuff to tell us what we might be able to exploit. There was the old Winsploit exploit suggester, but ever since Microsoft changed updates to be cumulative updates, it's not very good at suggesting. It's skipping the details. It's like, well, you're missing this quick fix in your database of Windows Update locally, so you're probably vulnerable. And that's not how it works anymore. We get new versions of DLLs and executables with cumulative updates. So if it's old enough, that might be useful. What's newer is the next generation tool, which is doing a better cross-referencing of versions that are contained within the knowledge base articles that tell us which DLLs are vulnerable and executables and whatnot. So my advice is to try those. I often use Sherlock as well, written by Rostamous. It's a PowerShell script looking for some of the big ticket items, some of the more common things. But it'll look at the version of Windows, and then it will look at, depending upon the version of Windows, the build number, which version of the DLL was vulnerable or executable or whatever it is that the vulnerability was. So if it's looking for Eternal Blue or whatever, it'll know exactly for that build what version that file should be and tell you if it's vulnerable. Very more precise thing. But I like it because it's quick. Most of your common wins will show up. And it is, again, a PowerShell thing, so I can just, whoop, import it into Empire. It makes that sound whoop, right there, and it's usable. Now, Rostamous, though, he's one of those guys who jumped on the C-sharp bandwagon, so he's not supporting Sherlock anymore. I have my own fork I started contributing to, but I need to catch up on some of the latest updates, the bigger CVEs. I need to add to it. But he moved everything to Watson. He went, let's do this in C-sharp. And so that's what Watson is. It's currently maintained. So look for that project if you want. Windows exploit suggestions, those are your best options, besides PowerUp, which we use in the exercise. For Linux, there's a few out here. The ones that I've had the most benefit of has been the version 1.4 of the Unix Privest Check. It's been pretty good for those random, weird, embedded Linux devices I sometimes find myself on. But more specifically, as far as tactics-wise, not strategy, but if I want to look at very intimate details of a process or an executable, this CheckSec script, originally written by Tobias Klein, but he stopped maintaining it in 2014. This is that same guy that wrote the Scoopy-Doo, Am I in a VM tool, and some of those other things. You may remember his name. He has done a few pretty awesome things, but this is one of them. You point this at one of those candidate files like the custom app we mentioned. It'll say, hey, that's an SUID, or it's not participating in ASLR, it's not compiled with Stack Canaries, and give you some other information that might lead you further down the exploitation path, as well as, hey, you've got a known vulnerability in that kernel module that's running for this particular device driver, or the kernel's vulnerable to erase condition, or whatever. A large list of that, so you have some options there. Okay? So, sorry, it's like we missed a couple of slides somehow. I didn't reintroduce the exercise, but as this was supposed to be, and it is, a follow-on to the previous exercise where you can continue working from the ones you already have, you can use this, do the launcher power up I showed you, and run your power up. The idea was to walk you through the power up way. You can follow on to the previous exercise. You still have the agents running. You don't have to start new agents. No starting listeners. Just use it. It's just included there for completeness if you're just picking up next week or something. One of the things you should see, though, when you run this, it's going to say, well, you know what? You are in the admin group. Why don't you just run a bypass UAC, and now you truly have your admin privileges. There'll also be other things it might show you. You also have to pick which bypass UAC. You might have different results depending upon your target environment. Ours will work the way it is. Here, just like I showed you with using Mimikittens, we're using Sherlock to look for vulnerabilities. It may suggest some to you. You can maybe find something. Again, if you have your admin privileges, you can just get system, much like in Meterpreter. And you can walk through this on your own time and run the old Mimikatz. Now, we don't talk a lot about Mimikatz. We assume you've already got that. It's advanced penetration testing. You should have already played with Mimikatz. If you haven't, this will be a lot of fun. Depending upon the environment, whether or not it is, a modern version of Windows 10 is not going to have clear text passwords from the NT hashes, but you might have other passes stored, right? From the credential vault, Mimikatz will pull those in. RDP, for example, credentials will come in. All right, so that's the second half of the exercise. What I'd like to do is to continue. You can finish on your own time, but since we're running a little short on time, I'm going to continue with the AMSI and other bypasses in the modern situation, and then we'll have the boot camp. So, some things to keep in mind here. Windows does their name resolutions in this way, which is useful for responder-style attacks. First time Windows needs to decide, and this, by the way, isn't just for Windows. This is the same for Windows networking, Samba, network attached storage devices, Macs running Windows networking. You still have some of the same similar issues, so keep that in mind. But Windows will say to itself first, is this my own name? If it doesn't have an answer, because it's not its name, is it in my NetBIOS cache? That's the next thing a Windows workstation will ask itself. Servers don't always ask this immediately, but it will say, is it in my NetBIOS cache? Even if you don't have NetBIOS enabled, it actually checks the cache. It's pretty silly. It's an empty cache because it's not enabled, but it does check the cache. Then it's going to look for, does that show up in my host file? If that doesn't work, let's actually look for it in DNS. DNS servers could ask, hey, I'm looking for this host name. Doesn't get an answer. Then where does Windows look? Well, it checks this other one, the lmhost.sam from an older DOS, Landman legacy thing. Then it gives up on those. It will check LLMNR. This is basically a multicast. It's DNS over peer-to-peer. It still looks like a query like DNS, an address record, and a response. You get those same things, but it's anybody got a DNS answer for this? And then again, anybody can answer, right? So that's our pretty easy thing for us to hijack as an attacker. But if we could maybe get earlier in this progression, we might be able to replace ourselves somewhere man the middle wise and do something like yesterday by manipulating these. Finally, if NetBIOS is still enabled, it will make a new NetBIOS request if it still doesn't get an answer. All right, so keep that in mind. That's real useful for us for things like, using Responder. And we don't really spend time using Responder. It's one of the other things we expect you to already have experience with. But for alternatives, we have Responder. There's Invey. There's the Potatoes, which all had different derivations. There's also the Juicy Potato, which I ran out of room and gave up on the potato progression here. All designed to try to catch Windows doing some name resolution, give it something to authenticate to, and steal the hash from that, right? That's what those have. Those are useful here. We're actually cheating a few things, and we're still talking about privilege escalation and lateral movement, post-exploitation here. We have access to the network, and we're trying to do something. If we do something like, let me back up, we can make DNS not work and not give us a legitimate answer. Does anybody have any ideas of how we can make DNS not work right? Denial of service to DNS server is usually what people say first, which is okay. We can also denial of service to the machine. If we exhaust all of the UDP ports on the machine, it cannot make new DNS requests. We can do that. That's the default posture. We can use up all the UDP traffic. It can't make new DNS requests. Even if we're not doing it on the same machine, we can try to create outbound UDP traffic that uses those ports. Doesn't matter if there's a firewall. And that way, we're on the machine, making sure that something like a system service can't make DNS requests and connect out so that we can force one of these other things that take advantage of, like LLMNR or NetBIOS. I love, too, Mubix. Rob Fuller had a lot of great NetBIOS scanning techniques. One of them was, let's just poison everybody's NetBIOS cache before they actually ask for it. Let's just spray out their DNS names via NetBIOS. I should say host names via NetBIOS, so that people come to us maliciously, because the first thing they'll check is the cache when they do actually try to do something. Poison the NetBIOS cache before anybody needs it, and you'll be able to bring people to you. All right? So we can do something like what we did yesterday with the UNC path in the browser to get some password hashes. And even if it's not a user doing it, we can make the system do NTLM authentication over HTTP, and that's what Responder does. Well, one of the things it can do, or those other tools I mentioned, right? So keep that in mind. That can be local to the LAN, local to the machine. We might be able to combine several of these different things to collect hashes. You don't have to know all the dozens of ways these tools work. I'll do several tricks. But it all boils down to there's something happening automatically, looking for a host. Responder or one of these tools acts as that host. And then tries to collect a hash from whatever service or automatic thing is happening. Okay? A couple of footnotes here, like dealing with UAC. UAC is one of those funny things Microsoft created to protect ourselves. Like adding that dialogue when you download something from the internet and run it, it says, you just downloaded this, are you sure you want to run it? It might be evil. It doesn't really protect you if you insist on running it, and most users will click through. The point of UAC is to temporarily remove your admin privileges so that if you were like in a viral infected kind of a situation, it's a little less damaging until you actually answer that UAC dialogue. So there's going to be a ton of ways to get that back. And I believe, this is my belief, it would be amazing if I'm wrong at some point in the future, there will always be a way to bypass UAC, practically. I think because of what Microsoft had to go through with making Vista livable, which became Windows 7, they can't be as aggressive as they wanted to with this control, and there will always be something that is auto-allowed to run things with those full admin privileges. And that's all bypass UAC is finding something that is auto-accepting. It's already answering okay to that dialogue. And there's a few subtle details on that, but that's the general idea. Depending upon the build of Windows, different techniques work. One of my favorite is dropping a file like this in this directory. You can write there as admin and not even have your high privileges. You're still running in medium context. You can write to there, put in meterpreter or whatever in DLL form, run this file. This one automatically gets its UAC privileges back. Its high integrity MIC label shows up and you've now bypassed it. That's one that worked. Every time I've tried it, I haven't tried on this year's version of Windows 10. Worked great, but there are, definitely dozens. I don't think there's hundreds, but there's definitely over 100 different ways known to bypass UAC. Microsoft has also said not a security boundary with UAC, even though it is a security feature. They don't call it a boundary because you already had those privileges. They're just temporarily removed for you. It's like if you're at your bar and you give your keys to the bartender or somebody else, you will get your keys back eventually, just maybe not right away. They're still yours. You get your privileges back with UAC bypass. As I was saying, Microsoft, though, for the bug bounty situation, no bug bounties being paid for UAC bypasses because there's just so many. They don't want to deal with that. They are slowly fixing them, though, slowly. So keep that in mind going forward in the future. Other things to keep in mind, Microsoft has branded everything Windows Defender. So we talk about AppLocker, and on Windows 10, it's called Windows Defender Application Defenses. We have that. AMSI is something we'll look at next. Basically, all AMSI is doing is providing a little bit of an easier way to deal with the powerful attack scripts we're using all the time. And bad guys are using all the time. There's a little bit of behavior detection, but for the most part, what we're really dealing with when we're trying to fight our command and control detecting capability, we're getting our tools caught sometimes. And it is always a Cold War type of a battle where as it changes, we have to switch and break. What are we going to be able to take advantage of? Some of those frameworks are a little easier than others. For example, the ones that use .NET might be pretty easy to take advantage of because that is so much of what Windows does. But yet again, maybe Windows Defender has an easier time, I should say, to detect malicious stuff because there is a published API. There is the normal way to do it. So maybe .NET frameworks are better under certain conditions, maybe not. But just try a different one, is my point. And keep in mind, especially when, like the PowerShell question, is it going to be useful in the future? Yes, because PowerShell is going to be useful in the future. So an attack tool, you still have to deal with a little bit. All you really need to do is think about living off the land or look at those LOL bins, binaries that are useful for an attacker. You can take advantage of what's also there. There's some other fun stuff too for alternatives, like if you have an experiment with Seatbelt from Spectre Ops, it's got a lot of cool things. It's like one of those things you should always have handy. Seatbelt will let you test out a lot of different things. Okay, so a little honorable mention to Seatbelt there. The final non-boot camp exercise of the day is an AMSI bypass. It's a very quick exercise. So what you're going to do is you're going to first start the exercise. Like everything else, we have an initial batch file that sets us up. And then I've already, to save you typing time, already typed in a combination of things that, spoiler here, actually get detected, and you're going to try to evade them. It's not a big surprise. We're going to use Covenant, and we're also going to run into the problem where it starts getting detected. All right? You could use Magic Unicorn and Metasploit as well, but we're going to focus on this one. First, you'll start with Covenant. You're going to run the one I have with the .NET run, and you're going to log in Covenant and Deadlist. If you ever have to ask yourself what the password might be this week, assume it's Deadlist, by the way, especially going forward in the week. You're going to log in locally, create a listener, and you're basically just going to be able to do basic commands with this. You're going to run into some issues with some of the detections, and then you're going to run to this point, coming up here, we're doing the HTA, where stuff starts getting detected, all right? We try to use an HTA, we try to use a fake plugin, and we get these potentially unwanted software error messages. So, just like a normal pen test, you're going to find yourself in this situation, and the point is, you need to stop and see how do I work around this. So, when Windows Defender starts catching this, the idea is, you're going to go through, you can read the report, manually see what it was, and try to detect it. But if you want to use what we have here, I've got this test AMSI PS1 script. Now, there's some stuff that's just Windows Defender known evil signatures, and there's some that's AMSI, which is really looking for just string detection. Literally, that's the main feature. So it may be partially here, maybe something else, but I've got this little script to help us. It zeroes out the event log and helps us see, better isolate how our thing is getting detected. And we're going to switch to individual commands instead of the whole Covenant grunt, which is the equivalent of a stager. An agent, when it's running, is a grunt. But what's preventing us from getting that execution? Well, we're going to do some baby steps here. We're going to regress back to testing. And so you're going to do this. You're going to see, I saw some of you do this before, working ahead. You're going to get, when you try to run invoke obfuscation, we're going to get that script contains malicious content. Okay? So what can we play with? We can see that there are certain things that match. These are actually the names that it says it is are based on the signature that was created. They're not obviously the same thing. We didn't actually use PS Attack. It was just the exact same way PS Attack does it. That was the signature that was created. Once you see that, you can experiment on your own, or we're running low on time. Spoiler alert, look at the last batch file. All you have to do is actually create a separation in this string and this other string. There's two of them, one before the semicolon, one after. You see the word the abbreviation AMSI. Change that string a little bit, and it no longer gets detected. It's pretty funny. Now, this is, again, if Windows Defender is updating or something, this can change at any time. That's why we have this process of running it and trying to find out where it's getting detected, because that's what we find in the wild all the time. All right? So I kind of walked through the exercise. You can look through the screenshots, do it on your own. I also want to introduce the boot camp, and then you can work on whatever you like. Okay? I know we're running out of time, but let me just introduce it. It's just going to take a moment. The VMs are already running, but if you would like to dive into this, you can. I highly encourage you, though, to finish the other exercises first, because this will go faster if you finish the other ones. The idea with the boot camp was to tie together some of the stuff yesterday, some of the stuff today, and you can use anything you like, really. The targets will be up the rest of the week. If you don't finish it tonight, that's perfectly okay. It is normal that only a few people finish it in the first night. It's kind of designed to be more of an open testing environment for you, too. You can play around with it all week if you like. You don't have to follow the instructions. My only real rule is don't interfere with other people trying to do the exercises. So don't attack other people. You can still attack these environments if you like. Basically, the context of the problem is the customer wants you to test the security of the DLP. They want you to test it out. There is a couple of paths to this. One of them is you can look at the stager that a junior pen tester is having problems with and try to become his Empire server and receive those connections that the agent would be running. Or you could just run your own fresh one on your own machine, which you already have agents on your Windows 10 machine from earlier today. You can just use those and steal the credentials from that. All right? But this data loss prevention solution is basically mimicking some of the tools commercially that I mentioned earlier today. We're going to try to tie together the escape and escalation, and secondary goal is to tie together things from earlier yesterday. All right? If you really must scan, you are allowed to scan, but I'm telling you, you're wasting your time. All right? Don't bother scanning. It's just going to waste your time. You have a range you can scan if you really must scan. If you see any machine from 10.10.20, like if you see a connection, that is fair game. But I don't want you to scan it directly. I want it to be a little more of a surprise. It's not going to break anything if you scan it. It's just it spoils the fun. I want you to wait till you see a connection. And then you can, if you want to do a man in the middle like we did yesterday, go for it. If you want to actually do something else with it, you can. Okay? Not a social engineering exercise, but I'm willing to entertain certain, you know, stories. It's just, that's not the goal. If you do deface a website or something, keep it PG-13 so that we don't get in trouble. Having an open environment. But those are really the only thing we have for rules, okay? This basically is in the form of a challenge. So there's not a A to B to C to D to E to win instructions in the boot camp exercise in the book. But there are, here's something you can do with Metasploit on a Server 2003 machine. Here's something you can do on Server 2008. Here's something you can do on somewhere else. It's kind of like in pieces. So you can kind of look at that and use it. But I want you to tie together the information you have. That's the purpose here, not to just read the answer and do exactly what's in the book. All right? So start from that batch file. If you can get to the CEO secret plans, you've proved that the data loss prevention isn't good enough. And that's the point. All right? I love to have this slide in there because it bugs certain people in SANS. This has nothing to do with the environment you're in. The point of this slide is if you find yourself, like you're doing a phishing attack, and you have an agent running, stop and think about what you're looking at. You know, what's its purpose? Abuse what it's supposed to be able to do. So if you're on a mobile user, what would you look for? VPN keys. How does it connect? That's what you're looking for. If it's a server, what does the server do? Does it talk to the database server? Does it talk to a different kind of server? What does it do? Is it a user? What does that user do? Abusing what is allowed is what you want to look for, not just, is there a service that hasn't been patched? You know, that's what we're trying to take advantage of. All right? So start, run the bootcamp.bat file. It's going to do a few things. You can look at the junior.bat file, reverse engineer it, or you can just, like I recommend, use your agents you've already made today, since we're running low on time, to steal the credentials that the DLP solution uses and go from there. All right? Steal the password that this batch file effectively makes by using the things we worked. All right? You're going to see this. You'll also notice that you could just dive in as a normal user. What do they do? A normal user would click on this Office 2007 link. You also can, if it seems like it's really busy because everyone's attacking it brutally, you can use alternative links as well. If you're doing a really good job of post-exploitation, stealing the credentials, you will find credentials for other machines that don't have shortcuts to them. And yes, those are fair game to interact with because they're inside the scope we mentioned. Okay? So you have like five different ways to start if you want to really look at it and dive in a different way. Or you can start with the front door and just execute this and say, all right, let me get into that desktop and escape that environment, and I'll go from there, whichever way you like.